to Day On Against the Grain, Revolution and Worker Self-Management, Eruptions of Worker Radicalism, and the Democratic Restructuring of Workplaces. In his latest book, Victor Wallace considers what it takes to effect fundamental transformation in the area of workers' control. I'm CS. We'll revisit a conversation with the radical scholar and author of Socialist Practice, Histories and Theories, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What if workers, not bosses, made all the important decisions in their workplaces? What if employees, not management, democratically decided what to produce, how to produce it, and what should be done with what's produced? In other words, what if workers' self-management, or workers' control, was the order of the day? Socialists have long had their eye on this elusive prize. Victor Wallace, in his new book, believes lessons can be learned from past periods of revolution and upheaval, lessons that could help guide current and future efforts to achieve fundamental social transformation. For each of the historical case studies he examines, Wallace considers the capacities of the workers, the role of political leadership, and many other factors. Victor Wallace was for two decades the managing editor of the journal Socialism and Democracy. He's a professor in the liberal arts department at the Berklee College of Music in Boston. Victor's new book is Socialist Practice, Histories and Theories. When he joined me recently to discuss a chapter in his book about workers' control and revolution, I asked him how integral workers' control is to the socialist vision.
Historical experience shows that if you attempt to merely expropriate the capitalist class but not change the production relations, you retain the stratification in the society. That goes against what I consider to be the basic essence of socialism or communism, which is the elimination of class differences. In order to eliminate class differences, they have to be eliminated at the workplace, so that instead of having a command type management, you have democratic management. That's why you have self-management, which is a synonym for workers' control, workers' self-management.
How important have revolutionary periods been in terms of showing the potential and the reality of workers' control?
Well, I argue that they've been very important in the sense that in a revolutionary period where everybody is aware of it, it brings out people's participation. It brings out their connection with what's going on. It reminds them that history can be affected by what they, as ordinary people, people who are not usually politically active, how it can be affected by what they do. There's a kind of mobilization of ordinary people. And so what I'm saying in connection with workers' control is that this is where you have an opportunity as a worker within your own place of work, within your own establishment, to participate in a historical transformation. And I think the fact that enormous changes are taking place serves as a kind of encouragement for people to take initiative in situations where they would not have dreamed of doing so earlier.
You examine in one chapter of your new book, Socialist Practice, Histories and Theories, you examine a number of case studies, historical situations, revolutions, revolutionary periods, and you begin with Russia. Where did the Bolshevik leadership stand on the issue of workers' control, both in the period before the October 1917 revolution and after it?
Here we have a very clear answer in terms of the actual writings of Lenin himself, who before that revolution was very much in favor of workers' control, but who in the situation that he faced after the Bolsheviks took power, where they were faced with the extreme urgency of increasing or maintaining production, he had no patience for the kind of experimentation that would be involved in workers' control. So you have direct statements of his to the effect that the entire workforce has to be subordinated to the will of one. That's what he said, underlined, italicized, the will of one. And he explicitly referenced the German model and what he's described their system at that time as being, namely state capitalism. He did not say that it was socialism. He said it was state capitalism, the situation that they had in 1918. And under those conditions, the German enterprise of that time was his explicit model.
So did Lenin mean that former capitalists should play a role in Soviet industry as it developed? And did he mean that the hierarchy that went along with capitalist enterprises somehow had to be continued despite? And it was clear, I mean, the Bolsheviks did adopt the slogan of workers' control in spite of the rhetoric of workers' control.
Well, I think that the way he viewed it was as a matter of skill and understanding and ability, and that they needed to make use of the skills of capitalist management in order to run the enterprises. And the way he reconciled that with the revolutionary requirements was by having their operations overseen by political officials, so that they were not just operating strictly as capitalists, but they had a kind of oversight, you might say, exercised by representatives of the party.
And what do you make of that argument that, you know, the nascent Soviet Union was bent on economic growth? It had to catch up with other countries. It saw results as more important, as you write, than processes.
Well, in a way, they were forced into that situation because from the very beginning, they faced the united antagonism of all the great capitalist powers. So they knew, Lenin knew, and the whole leadership knew that they had to build up their own independent industry. And it was a matter of survival for them. So they had no choice. And I think that was the sense of urgency, the sense of not being able to engage in the kind of experimentation in a way that would have been necessary in order for them to work through, you know, all the kinds of trial and error that would be necessary for people previously unfamiliar with operating their enterprises to begin doing so. The urgency of the situation forced them into these kinds of draconian policies.
And there was a concern as well on the part of Lenin and the Bolshevik leadership that there was a counter-revolution that threatened the Bolsheviks, right? I mean, he saw defeating the counter-revolution as a key priority. Did he use that to justify the stance he took toward workers' power and worker self-management?
Well, my impression is that everything he did during that period of the first 3 years in power was affected or almost dictated by that situation. Everything was a matter of survival. So whether it was building up industry, whether it was or sending armies to resist the foreign invasion, because, of course, as we know, there was a foreign invasion by the Allied troops from World War I got together to invade also Soviet Russia at that time to support the counter-revolution. So the Bolshevik government was really besieged, and everything it did was determined by that condition.
So then what's the lesson we can take from this part of the Soviet experience, the disinclination toward working toward true workers' control? What does this tell us about whether socialist revolution inexorably leads to the establishment of workers' control?
What I argue is that socialist revolution has to include both the expropriation of the capitalist class and the empowerment of the working class. And actually, there's another chapter in my book where I discuss an excellent book written by Michael Leibowitz called The Contradictions of Real Socialism, where he goes in great detail into this issue as it was expressed later in the process, you know, long after the Communist Party of the Soviet Union was firmly established in power, and you had this situation that although in a positive sense from the workers' standpoint, there was a certain security in the workplace, certain security against being fired, and a certain control over their immediate conditions, that however, the actual structure of authority in terms of what was produced and how it was produced and how much and so on remained completely in the hands of management. So the problem is then generally that they did not do away with the stratification that existed within the capitalist enterprise. And as a result, the society as a whole remained stratified, and the dominant stratum, or the superior stratum in terms of power, was therefore the one that eventually easily switched over to becoming a capitalist class, you know, in the 1980s. So the point is that in order not to have this kind of reversion to a class society, you have to have democratization in every sphere. And I'd say not just in the workplace, but the workplace is really the central site where this has to be accomplished.
Could one say, Victor, that if the workers had a kind of a tradition and a traditional way of organizing to enable them to do self-management and to put into effect self-management initiatives, that there might have been a better chance that workers' control could have, if not flourished, at least made important strides in the early Soviet Union?
Well, it's conceivable in an abstract way, but I think all the factors that determined that the first revolution would be in Russia also determined the fact that you'd have a working class that was not, let's say, experienced in terms of regular democratic types of process, such as you could have, at least in principle, in legal trade union activity. I mean, the regime that existed prior to the Bolshevik Revolution was one of extreme repression, and any kind of organization of workers was a kind of a political challenge. It was not really directed towards the ongoing functioning of the enterprise. So when you suddenly had the release from the capitalist power, the immediate impulse, and this is one gets from the accounts of the history of 1917, there was a lot of, there was a certain euphoria at one level, but also it was unstructured. I mean, the people had possibilities, opportunities, whether material or just in terms of living, opened up suddenly that had never existed before. But it was not a situation that was conducive to some kind of discipline and order. And so you did have, by all the documentation I've seen, a certain kind of expression of immediate impulses. And this was not at all conducive to a kind of organized worker control type thing. I mean, one of the things specifically to mention that connection is apparently there was a great amount of drinking. I mean, and drinking alcohol has been always a problem in traditionally in Russia. And this was a kind of situation where it would be indulged in by the workers and so on. And so this was the kind of thing that alarmed Lenin and that led him to think that the only response, given the urgency of the situation, was to exercise dictatorial authority. And he used the word dictatorial in that context.
Victor Wallace is his name. His new book is Socialist Practice, Histories and Theories. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. He's a professor in the liberal arts department at the Berklee College of Music. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And we are talking about a portion of Victor's new book, a chapter about revolutions and revolutionary periods. And we'll turn to more of those periods, among them Italy in 1920, Spain in 1936 to 1939, the Spanish Civil War, and Chile from 1970 to 1973 under Allende. 1973, of course, was the year that Salvador Allende was ousted by a CIA-supported military coup that installed Pinochet. But I want to ask you, before we move forward, Victor, about this book more generally. What were you trying to do with this book, Socialist Practice?
Well, I was essentially really bringing together a great variety of topics that I had written about over the years, because it was never possible for me earlier to conceive of a book. My writing projects were always determined by some immediate situation or some immediate experience, and the logical expression of that was an article. But the articles covered a great range of topics, which when I put them together did seem to provide a kind of cross-section of topics and arguments and issues that would be pertinent to a general understanding of the crisis of our time. So it starts with a kind of general survey about Marxism after 100 years after the Russian Revolution, and then goes into a chapter which is directly reproduced from the time it was written, which was at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall, which was obviously a historical moment. And my attempt to analyze that moment at the time, that's one of the chapters of the book. But other chapters deal with issues of dialectics, species questions, the history of the United States left. There's a long chapter, actually the longest chapter of the book is about the US left, especially in the 1960s. A general chapter also about the phenomenon that we're very familiar with of lesser evil voting, and a historical analysis of that. And then I get also into some film reviews, which get me into the experience of the Black Power movement in the United States and into mass incarceration in the United States, of which I had a good deal of direct experience doing prison work. And then reviews of three films about Latin American revolution, because Latin America was actually the first subject really of my professional expertise in academia. It was a subject that I studied in graduate school based on the fact that I was getting into graduate school in the aftermath of the Cuban Revolution, and that this was the scene of the greatest apparent hope for future transformation globally. And then finally, the last chapter before the conclusion is a chapter entitled Song and Vision in the U.S. Labor Movement.
The book again, Socialist Practice, Histories and Theories, by my guest Victor Wallace. Let's turn to Italy, 1920. You write that Italy in 1920 saw the first instance of factory seizures in a capitalist democracy. What happened, Victor, in September of that year?
Well, there were factory seizures really essentially in the automobile industry in Turin. And one way in which people will relate to that was this was the experience out of which came the work of Antonio Gramsci. He was actively involved in those upheavals. He was a journalist. He was the one who wrote about what was going on for the people who were going through it. And it was out of that he developed his theories. But I think the general point about the experience itself is that it showed that one of the problems that had been cited by Lenin in reference to the Russian experience, namely the indiscipline and chaos among the workers, was not at all the case. Here you had a clear-cut example where the workers were very well organized, disciplined, and had a kind of a practical sense of things, and really were taking charge of things and showing that it could be done. And I think that was the important thing about it.
Antonio Gramsci, the Italian Marxist theoretician and writer and revolutionary and politician. So you referred to the self-discipline of the Italian workers. Is this then the key to understanding why the Italian factory occupation signaled, as you write, a major step forward for the workers compared to the Russian experience?
Sure. Yes. I mean, this was the early years of the Italian Communist Party. I mean, Gramsci was one of its founders, and so they had political experience in the context of being in the most advanced industry in the country. So they had a strong, let's say, strategic position in the economy, and at the same time they were well organized on their own, and they had been able to organize in ways that had not been possible for the Russian workers under the Tsarist regime. So it was just, you might say, a more mature working class in organizational terms.
You draw connections in this chapter in your book, Socialist Practice, between these factory seizures that lasted for less than a month, unfortunately, and the fascist takeover in Italy in 1922. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, I think the essential connection is just that the factory seizures, although they lasted only a short time, they were a real alarm signal to the Italian ruling class. And of course, Italy was the first country to come under fascist rule. It was not just the factory seizures, but also the fact that the Socialist Party of Italy had turned out the biggest electoral total in the 1919 elections. So Italy was in a situation where the working class was extremely strong, had shown its competence, and this alarmed the bourgeoisie, and so it was much more ready to turn to a fascist solution.
I want to move now to a portion of this chapter in your book, Socialist Practice on Revolutions, to the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939. And many of our listeners may know that there was a left-leaning Republican government that was trying to fight off a revolt staged by forces that came to be led by General Francisco Franco. In which sectors of the economy, of the Spanish economy during these years, was workers' control instituted, and how radical were the changes that were made?
I would say that it's not a matter of so much of sectors as it is of regions of the country, because the region of the country in which the fascist forces were held off, the region they were not able to occupy until they won a final victory in 1939, was the region especially of Catalonia, of which the principal city is Barcelona. And within that region, it wasn't just Catalonia, but that was the principal region. Barcelona was certainly the biggest city. Within that region, all the sectors of the economy came under, in effect, workers' control, including very importantly, the agricultural sectors. Agricultural collectives were formed spontaneously when they expropriated the landlords. There was not an interest in dividing it up into individual parcels. There was the impulse was to farm the land collectively. And I think one of the most important and interesting things about it is they also collectively ran the industrial operations and services in Barcelona as well, in the cities. And interestingly enough, from one of the accounts by Gaston Laval, who was a direct witness, since you were no longer employed in particular jobs by particular capitalists, but instead it was part of a community thing, when there was a need to move from one type of occupation to another, for example, even in seasonal terms, in the agricultural work, when it was not needed during the off season, that the workers involved in it could move into other sectors. And there was a kind of movement back and forth that was determined by collective decision, where they were free of the constraints of the market. So it was the fullest illustration of how some of this can happen. And this was under the inspiration, really, of the anarchist culture, which was a cooperative culture, very much that had developed in Spain. And that's one of the general things that I emphasize in the chapter, that the tradition of emphasizing workers' control has been historically associated with anarchism. And as I say, as I argue, this is a great and vital tradition for any kind of socialist movement, but it's not enough by itself, because if you only have that, and if you don't have a political control, then the movement can be suppressed. So what I argue and emphasize in that chapter is that socialism really is a combination of exercising power at the level of the state on the one hand, and having, on the other hand, from the opposite direction, a bottom-up structure symbolized by worker control.
You write that the real catalyst for workers' control initiatives in Spain in this period was provided by the reactionary forces in Spain. So they were responding to what the fascists were doing and had in mind, right?
Well, in a sense, I mean, that is to say, the popular uprising to defend the Republic was led in a way by the most radical social forces in the country, which were the anarchist forces. And then, of course, I mean, all this is mired in controversy, and I don't expect my word to be the last one on the subject. The Republic itself, which was the government of the Republic, which was a popular front coalition that included communists and bourgeois parties, they resisted the social revolutionary developments that were spurred by the anarchists, because they were afraid. They were looking on the international scene, and they wanted to have the aid of the Soviet Union. They were hoping not to antagonize the British, French, and American governments, and so they wanted to go slow. And so there was this kind of controversy. But I mean, the real energy at the heart of the military resistance to Franco was the mass involvement was very much associated with the revolutionary initiatives which were associated with workers' control.
The workers were at one point offered power, political power, by the president of Catalonia. Did they take it?
No, they declined it. They made this the same point that has historically been made by anarchists, that they don't like, or don't like, that's not strong enough. They reject state power in principle, and so they can't see themselves exercising it.
And what's the nature of that? I mean, is that a tragic misstep in your opinion? And if they had chosen to take power or to take a portion of power, might the scenario have been different?
That's very hard to say, because I mean the international alignment was so severely against the Republic. So I find it hard to imagine that even with such a response, you know, if they had been willing to accept state power, that they would have been able to hold off the combined forces of fascism in the country as a whole.
And back to the main argument you're trying to make in this chapter, in this book, what does Spain from the mid-1930s to the end of that decade and the workers' control initiatives that were put in place, worker self-management, democratic workplaces, workers actually participating in the decisions of the business enterprises in which they worked. What does that say about workers' control and the potential that it has and the conditions under which it can emerge and thrive?
It shows, for one thing, that every sector of the economy is one in which it's possible to think in terms of workers' control. And that goes back to an underlying point that I make at the very beginning of that chapter, which is that workers' control of the production process is the most natural thing in the world. It's capitalism that has arbitrarily and unnaturally stripped away the control function from workers and concentrated it in management. So you might say that it's the natural potential of human beings that was emerging in that situation. And if you ask what prompted it to emerge, it was, again, the kind of critical situation that they were forced into. Suddenly, their whole way of life was threatened by this fascist uprising, and everybody had to become active at that moment. And the cooperative culture that had existed among them for a long time was really their source of strength.
Victor Wallace joins me. We were talking about his new book, Socialist Practice, Histories and Theories. He teaches in the liberal arts department at the Berklee College of Music in Boston. We'll take a short break and speak more with Victor about his book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Victor Wallace joins me. He was for many years the managing editor of the journal Socialism and Democracy. His books include Red Green Revolution, The Politics and Technology of Eco-Socialism, and Democracy Denied, Five Lectures on U.S. Politics. He's got a new book out called Socialist Practice, Histories and Theories. I want to move to Chile, 1970 to 1973. So here we have a situation where we have a democratically elected leftist named Salvador Allende, who is in power before he was ousted by the military coup in 1973. What were the features and contours of workers' control as it was implemented in Chile at this time?
Chile had a long history of working class organization, and this was the first of the elected governments that we've encountered in my survey that was actually supportive in principle of the workers. So this was a great encouragement, especially at a crisis moment after 2 years of Allende being in office. I mean, his whole term was one in which this activity was taking place, because from the moment that he was elected, the United States, as well as the Chilean bourgeoisie, were determined to make it fail, including by economic measures. And so this, again, created a situation in which it was urgent for the workers to take some kind of control of the situation. And they were encouraged to do this to some extent, because in the principal industry of copper, there was a government formation which administered it, and which encouraged worker control developments. But the whole thing came to a head really after 2 years of Allende's government in October 1972, when there was a concerted effort on the part of the Chilean bourgeoisie to shut down the economy and bring about its collapse, specifically shutting down production at one of the biggest copper mines. And that was a moment at which the workers took it over and were running it successfully, that they kept it going while the bosses shut it down, what we'd call a lockout, but the workers kept it going. This was really the climax, you might say, of that development. But unfortunately, Allende was persuaded by perhaps pressure from the military. It's hard to say exactly what. He was persuaded to turn the enterprise back over to its owners in return for a guarantee from the military that the congressional elections that were scheduled for March 1973 would be allowed to take place. So in a sense, you might say that that concession stopped the kind of forward march of the worker control process. The other thing that needs to be said about that period is, again, that not just in that enterprise, but in all the neighborhoods, there was an enormous amount of self-organization on the part of the people. So, for example, there was a lot of speculation and hoarding and shortages of consumer goods. And so the neighborhoods themselves would take things into their own hands to assure the fair distribution of necessary supplies, that kind of thing. All this was developing to a very high level of effectiveness in that time.
And as far as industries, the takeover by workers of factories, the operation of them collectively, that happened in industries other than mining?
Yeah, I mean, there was a textile industry in which they also took over as well. It was a generalized phenomenon, and it was encouraged and supported by the government. And there was an enormous amount of political consciousness and a really intense political consciousness on the part of the working class during that whole period, because it had been evolving over the course of many years. Because when Allende was elected in 1970, that was the fourth time that he had run for president. Each time, every 6 years, the number of his votes increased and the awareness increased and the kind of the intensity of the situation grew. And, you know, by 1970, of course, from the moment that he was elected, his government was under threat from the United States, especially, but also from the Chilean ruling class. And it was an extraordinary experience, of which there's also a section in my book where I'm reviewing this amazing film called The Battle of Chile, which gives you a visual impression of all these conflicts and shows you the intelligence, the collective intelligence of the workers and their resourcefulness in this whole period. So it was, again, perhaps much more than anything that could have been done at the government level. The mobilization, the activation of the workers was what created this kind of alarm for the Chilean bourgeoisie, not to mention the United States and Nixon, which were opposed to it and trying to destroy it from the outset.
Would you say Chile 1970 and 1973 represents one of the outstanding examples of a workplace struggle, you know, the workers struggling in the workplace, combining or going hand in hand with the state level struggle, at least for a while?
Yeah, I mean, it was the case where up to that time, there was the closest collaboration, the greatest degree of collaboration between workers and state level. However, it was not a total collaboration because the state nonetheless felt very much constrained by constitutional requirements. And so, for example, when there were comparable movements within the armed forces, rank and file people wanting to prevent their officers from subverting the state, Allende put his foot down against that. He came out on the side of the commanding people against that. So in the chapter that I have, I refer to the case where the cooperation between government and workers went further as being the later case of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, where, again, you had a situation in 2002 where there was an attempt on the part of the bourgeoisie to break down the Venezuelan economy by locking people out. And the workers took over and essentially they rescued Chavez. And subsequently, there were instances where workers would take over particular factories and Chavez would ratify it. So I think the collaboration went further in the case of Venezuela than it had gone in the case of Chile. Because in Venezuela, Chavez was not threatened by the armed forces. Chavez had the collaboration of the armed forces. He came out of the armed forces himself, and any sectors of them that were opposed to him were effectively neutralized after the attempted coup of 2002.
And as far as lessons for today, and I think you've alluded to a number of them as we've gone along, but Victor, you bring up in this chapter, in again your book, that there are at least two issues I want to focus on. One is the separation between political strategy, and you know here we can refer to, for example, or think about the ways in which socialist governments had to deal with threats, perceived threats, and actual threats to their existence, whether from the capitalist class or from external factors, factors external to the country, and the self-management impulse, how that separation between political strategy and the self-management impulse could be overcome. Well, let's start there. How do you see that division possibly being addressed in a way that allows workers' control and self-management to emerge?
I think what's very important is that any political strategy developed by a revolutionary party includes an emphasis not only on taking over the reins of the state, but also and simultaneously on promoting democratic structures in every sphere of society, including, of course, obviously, the production enterprise. So if that's part of their agenda from the beginning, it will also determine a certain approach to creating the party that will be the instrument of that kind of transformation. It will emphasize the importance of democratic structures and processes within the party itself. So there's very much a democratic culture that's evolved. And I think one of the things that I found that was common to all the cases of workers' control was this culture of cooperation. And that's something that is developed over time, but that can be promoted consciously by political parties. And so you might say it's what I refer to also elsewhere in the book as overcoming the supposed contradiction between leadership on the one hand and democracy on the other, because leadership is often associated with the idea of a vanguard and democracy is supposed to be in opposition to that. Well, that has to be overcome in the sense you cannot do without leadership, but the leadership has to be absolutely accountable. And now this is a very commonplace kind of thing to say, but it has not been sort of realized within the context of revolutionary organizations, that the emphasis on the transformation of each institution within the society, not just the state, not just government, but the production enterprise, but one might also say the community, the family, and so on, all these institutions, all these aspects of the society have to be permeated by a kind of democratic culture so that there's not this separation between the need to take control away from those who have oppressed us up to now, on the one hand, and the need to erect something positive in place of it, on the other. I mean, what has plagued so much of the history of attempted revolutions is the phenomenon that a revolution produces a leadership which, for one reason or another, is driven, maybe against its will, to exercise power in a way that replicates some of the ways in which power was exercised under the previous regime. And this is what has to be prevented. And here I'm saying again that the only thing that can possibly prevent it is the development of such a culture.
I'm CS. My guest is Victor Wallace, and we are talking about his new book, Socialist Practice, Histories and Theories. Wallace is spelled W-A-L-L-I-S. How big of a problem, Victor, in terms of agitating for workers' control and for socialism, is the fragmentation of the working class? And what has discrimination and segregation done to cause or to foster that fragmentation?
The fragmentation is what has decisively weakened the U.S. working class, and the racial division, the imposed racial division, has absolutely been essential to that fragmentation. And I would say it's more than just discrimination. It's really a phenomenon in which a whole category of the working class has historically been, well, you can really say dehumanized at a certain level. And we're even witnessing this kind of dramatically underscored at the present time by the lynching. So with a fragmented working class, you have an ineffective opposition to the power of capital, so that many of the types of reforms that in other capitalist countries have been obtained, most notably universal health care, have not been possible in the United States. And you might say all the institutions have conspired in a way to work against a kind of unification in this sense. And I would say part of this also is the way that the union structure in this country, the ethic of the unions as they have developed, has followed to some extent the business model. And unions have competed against each other for providing services to workers so that they end up having to depend for their healthcare insurance on what they can get out of a particular enterprise as a result of the intervention of their union, rather than having a government-guaranteed support. And we've just seen now how disastrous this is, because when you lose your job, you lose your health insurance. So this has weakened the working class generally. And I think workers' control is just one dimension of what the working class would be able to achieve if it were not divided in this way. And I would say, though, that within a particular enterprise, the antagonisms that might exist in the outer society may be overcome, and they may be overcome in the enterprise sooner than they would be elsewhere. So that's a promising possibility. If you do have democratic structures, that encourages the overcoming of antagonisms that are not based on fundamental interest conflict. I mean, because workers are not, there's no opposition of interest between, for example, white workers and black workers. It's a contrived thing. But in order to overcome that, they have to be in a situation where they can see the benefit of acting in concert.
Is systemic racism, is it an effort, a conscious effort, an intentional effort to, among other things, prevent people from recognizing common class interests?
I think it certainly originated that way. Theodore Allen's historical studies, I think, show that fairly clearly in the context of colonial Virginia in the 17th century, and also in subsequent cases which have been written about, you know, the whole Reconstruction period, when there was beginning in the United States a breakdown of the racial barrier in the southern states, and the kind of alarm that that created and the reaction that it produced, that there was enormous fear of black and white workers acting in unison. And this was the great phobia of the extreme southern races, to the extent that they saw communism, they defined it almost in terms of the mixing of the races and as a plot to weaken the American people. I mean, it's unbelievable the degree to which that became a part of the anti-communist culture, the effort to keep the races apart. And so this has become definitely deeply ingrained in this society.
And what about the identity politics that often arises as a result, as a consequence of racism? I mean, one could see that, and you do see it as a natural reaction of oppressed groups. But what happens then to the ability for workers across racial lines, ethnic lines, to unite?
Right. As I say, the identity politics reaction is an understandable initial reaction, but it stands in the way, you know, if it becomes the exclusive focus of attention, it stands in the way of recognizing common interests that span all the different identities as defined by gender, race, sexual orientation, age, ability, and so on. So all the people in these various sectors, if they are part of the working class, or they have a common class interest, which transcends whatever differences may exist among them on the basis of these identities. And of course, the striving of the dominant culture is to keep them focused on their separate identities, and even to appeal to them in certain ways, and to weaponize certain characteristics. And so you have phenomena like what we witness, again, with the white nationalism, which seeks to blame all the hardships of people, all the economic hardships, the failure of the government to serve their interests, to blame all that on some kind of external source. That's a kind of standard divide and rule type of tactic.
And let me ask you one question about your discussion of revolutionary Cuba. How important was workers' control in the lead up to the revolution in 1959 and or the immediate aftermath of the revolution?
In that chapter, I refer to Cuba as a different kind of case from the other ones I discussed, in the sense that the emphasis on workers' control did not come during the immediate period of revolutionary upheaval, but instead came as part of a conscious effort after the revolutionary government was already in power. But there's another in the chapter of reviews of revolutionary films, one of the films I review is the film about Che. And an important point I make there about Cuba is that its great contribution is the cultural transformation that it brought about, creating a culture of solidarity, a culture of a kind of global mission, as symbolized by its enormous training of healthcare providers, far in excess of its own national needs. This is its place in the world, in a sense of service, an ethic of service, which is inconceivable in the absence of a revolutionary transformation and culture. It was symbolized first when they had, in the early year of the revolution, high school students going out into the countryside to teach people how to read. And then later in disaster relief personnel or health workers going to many different countries in the world, including most recently in response to the COVID-19 crisis. So this is a really unique aspect of the Cuban Revolution, which I think is very important. I mean, Cuba was the case that sort of broke through the impasse between the US and the Soviet Union, which surrounded us when I was growing up. And it has retained, despite extraordinary obstruction and sabotage, literal sabotage from the United States, its commitment in this sense. And so it represents a very important positive example of the kind of transformation of ethics, you might say, or personal transformation that's possible on a large scale in the context of or as a result of revolutionary change.
Victor Wallace, former longtime managing editor of the journal Socialism and Democracy. He teaches liberal arts at the Berklee College of Music. His books include Red Green Revolution, The Politics and Technology of Eco-Socialism, and Democracy Denied, 5 Lectures on U.S. Politics. We've been talking about his new book. It's out from Palgrave Macmillan. It's called Socialist Practice, Histories and Theories. Congratulations, Victor, on your new book, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, C.S. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
And that interview first aired on June 8th of this year. And this is C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.